Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome back to the class on Ibn Ashir. We've been going through as quickly as we can, and we're coming to the end of the section on prayer now, inshallah. So I'm hoping that today we can finish it so that perhaps before Ramadan, we can at least have got fasting and zakat done in time, inshallah. So we reached last time, we were talking about what you do when you miss out or forget sunnahs from your prayer and how you make it right. Today we're talking about what you do when you miss out obligatory, essential elements of your prayer, such as a sajda or ruku or something like that. And these are called a rukun, a pillar, an essential element, something that without it, it would not be the prayer. It's not referring here, by the way, when it's to things like niyyah, the intention, or the takbiratul ihram, because those are two things that you couldn't have a prayer without. So there's no way of making them right. If you start a prayer without them, you have no prayer. So basically, you can't make those right. You have to then start again if you miss out the takbiratul ihram or you don't make the niyyah. But if you miss out a sajda in the course of your prayer or you miss out ruku', there are ways of making your prayer right. So he says, wastadrik ar-rukna, make right, repair the rukun, which I said is an essential element of the prayer, such as a sajda or a sitting or a ruku' or a standing out of ruku' or anything like that, one of the positions of the prayer. Make it right, repair it. So how do you do that? He says here, فَإِنْ حَالَ رُكُوعْ فَأَلْغِي ذَاتَ السَّهْوِ. So you make it right until حَالَ رُكُوعْ, until a ruku' comes between you and that thing that you did. So I'll give you an example. You're doing the prayer, you say Allahu Akbar, you go down into ruku' in your first rakat, then you come up, then you go down into sajda, and you only do one sajda. And then you stand up, and then you're reciting. And then you remember before the next ruku', then you simply drop into the sitting position, do the second sajda, and then stand up again and continue your rak'ah, and you've made your rak'ah right. You've repaired it. You've gone back and fixed the thing that was missing. If you have gone into ruku', then it depends what you missed before, whether you can make it right or not. The moment you go into ruku', you can't make up a previous ruku'. So if you missed out the ruku' in the first rakat, the moment you go into ruku', it's too late. What do you do then about the first rakat? فَأَلْغِي, you cancel it out. You nullify that rakat. It no longer counts as a rakat. So basically, you're now in your first rakat. What you did before doesn't count at all. It's not considered a rakat. If you missed out something like a sajda or a fatiha or something else in the first rakat, and you come into ruku' in the second rakat, you still have time to make it right. It finishes when your ruku' finishes, your ability to make it right. So when you stand up out of ruku', that's the time when you cannot make it right anymore. So if you remember while you're in ruku' in the second rak'ah that you missed out sajda, you go back, do that sajda, then come back to your position where you are. If you remember that you forgot a ruku', you can't do that. It's gone. If you've stood in your second rak'ah out of ruku', you can't make anything right from the first rak'ah. It's gone. So what happens then? He says, for alghi, so you cancel out that sahwi, the rakat that contains the forgetfulness, the rakat in which you forgot one of the obligatory elements. Wal bina yatur, and then you build, and then building is the way forward. What does he mean by that? He means that rather than making up that rakat at the end of your prayer and considering yourself to still be in the second rakat, and then you just make up the first rakat later on, you no longer consider yourself to be in the second rakat. You now consider that rakat to be your first rakat, and then you build on your prayer from there. So that's your first rakat. Then the next rakat, even though in some ways it might seem to be your third, you're building. So you consider that second rakat to actually be your second. So you did the surah, the fatiha and the surah in the first rakat. Then you did the fatiha and the surah in the second rakat, but you realize you missed something out in the first rakat, so it's gone. So in the third rakat, you do fatiha and a surah, not in the last rakat. You understand? Because you're building on what you have done that counts. You're not making up what's lacking. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
it'd be fine. No, you've cancelled that one. It doesn't count. It's as if it didn't exist.
You do five.
So you're doing five, but one of them was a deficient one.
Yeah.
So that deficient one, you've cancelled it out completely. Yeah. So say you remembered that deficient one in the third rakat. Now you've got two rakats that are correct, and that previous one that's not. So your second rakat becomes your first rakat. Your third rakat becomes your second rakat, and you continue in that way. In this situation, as we're going to come to in a minute, something's missing. Your second rakat doesn't have a surah in it. So there's something missing in your. Do you understand that? Is that clear? He'll come to that in a minute. He says, "Kafi' li man sallama." So the ruku' is what stops you being able to make right what came before, or coming out or completing the ruku' in the next rakat. What about if you're in the final rakat that you miss something out? There's no ruku' of the next rakat because it's the final rakat. So what's the thing that stops you being able to make that rakat right? The salam, yeah. So he says, kafi'li man sallama, like the action of the one who says, assalamu alaikum. He has to annul, nullify, or abrogate, cancel out the previous rakat, i.e. the last rakat. And then he stands up immediately with a takbiratul ihram, because he's left the inviolable state of prayer by saying assalamu alaikum, so he has to get back into it. Stands up with a takbiratul ihram, does that one rakat, then he's finished his prayer after that. Yeah. But in all of these cases, so he says here, kafi'li man sallama lakin yuhrimu, but he says the takbiratul ihram lil baqi, for what remains of his prayer, the rak'ah that he missed out. Wa tulul fasada mulzimu. But if he says assalamu alaikum and then a long time passes, or he gets involved in another activity. So he says assalamu alaikum, forgets that he's made a mistake in that final rakat, missed something out, gets up and does another prayer, like the nafila. Yeah? Too late. He can't make it right. He has to do the whole prayer again. Or he leaves the mosque. Even if you leave the mosque straight away after you finish that prayer, the act of leaving the mosque is you doing something else. So you've missed the opportunity to make that prayer right. You have to do the whole prayer again. Or you get involved in a conversation completely extraneous to the prayer, and then you can get deeply involved in this conversation with somebody. Again, you've missed the opportunity. It's the same as a long time passing. A long time passing could be 5 minutes, but you could be somebody who sits there after you've done the prayer and does a lot of dhikr after the prayer and recitation. As long as you're doing that and still connected to the prayer, even if it's quite a long time, you can make it right. But when you've left your place, and got involved in something else, or it's been an excessively long length of time, then it's better for you to do the whole prayer again. And in all of these cases, you've added something to your prayer. That whole incomplete rakah. Yeah, that's an addition. Or even when you went back and were able to fix it, you still had to go back and do an extra position, the previous one, because you have to go into a position from the previous position. So if you missed out ruku', you would go back to standing, this previous standing, and then go into ruku'. So you've added to your prayer. So what do you do when you add to your prayer?
Such a body.
Yeah, so prostrations of forgetfulness after the salam. So in all of these cases, even when it's talking about something which is an obligatory element that you've missed out and you've gone and corrected it, or when you completely had to cancel that rakah, in all of these cases, once you've completed your prayer, after saying assalamu alaikum, you do two prostrations of forgetfulness. So that's what you do when you miss out a fard element. That could be It could be a sajda, it could be two sajdas, it could be a ruku', it could be the standing out of ruku', any of those things. It could be the fatiha, and so on. The next one is, what do you do in cases of doubt? This happens to people a lot. You're praying, and you're unsure how many rakats you've prayed. Or you're praying, and you're unsure whether you did sajda yet. You did sajda in the previous, in that rakat. Say, for example, you've stood up out of ruku', and for some reason you think that you've done the sajdas, whereas in fact all you've done is gone into ruku'. And you think you're in the standing again. You may be quite distracted or something. And you suddenly think, oh, did I do sajdas or not? Maybe you did, but you don't know. You're 50-50 about it. That's just shirk. You know, could be that I did it, could be I didn't. What do you do in that case? That's what he's saying here. He said, man shakka, the person who has doubts, who is unsure about a rukun, fi rukun, one of these essential elements of the prayer, or a rakat, or even it could be about prayer itself. For example, you start praying, and you suddenly have a doubt. Oh, am I praying dhuhr or asr? Have I prayed dhuhr? Or which one am I praying? you know, because the two prayers that are in the same time, sometimes, you know, you got busy working or something, and something comes thing, and then you suddenly start praying, and then you're unsure whether you're doing dhuhr or asr. Somehow. All of these situations, he says, if you have doubt about something which is an essential thing in the prayer, bana ala al-yaqeen, you build on what is certain. So, for example, in the case of the dhuhr and asr, if you're unsure whether you've prayed both of them, you build on the fact that you're only doing dhuhr because it's the first, and then you have to do asr afterwards. If you're unsure if you've done three or four rakats, then you build on what you're certain of, which is three, and then you add another. If you're unsure about whether you've done one sajda or two sajdas, you build on what you're sure of, one sajda, and then you add another. In all of these cases, you build upon what you are certain of if you are somebody who is not usually affected by doubts of this sort. It's quite a rare occurrence. Just that one day you happened to be maybe very, very tired and sort of weren't focused, and those doubts came to you. If you are somebody who has these doubts all the time, what's called a mustankih. Basically, all the time means once a day. That's enough. Once a day, these sorts of doubts come to you. Then it's the opposite. You ignore those doubts. Mm. And you basically assume that you've done more rather than less. So you have the opposite position if this happens to you all the time, because the deen is yusr, the deen is ease. And these people who have these doubts, they can never get rid of those doubts. So they're always doing more and more and more and more. And perhaps, you know, every time that they listen to their doubts, it will make them have more and more doubts. So such people, the cure for their doubts is for them to ignore the doubts. Whereas the others who don't usually often have such things when they wonder how many rakats they've done, it's a rare occurrence. For them, the fact that it's a rare occurrence means that there may be some reality in it this time, so they should build upon what they're certain of. So that's the difference between the two. When you do have these doubts, then you should always do the sajdas after the salam, because the doubt itself is an addition to the prayer. But moreover, there is a chance that you did four, but you only thought you did, but you weren't sure. So you build on as if you'd done something extra in your prayer, and you do sajdas after the salam. Is that clear? لكن قد يبين. So this is still this. Well, yes, يسجد البعدية. He says, and he should say this. He should say should do the prostrations after the salam. Refers to everything that we've talked about today, by the way. So this is going back to the three lines that we've talked about. He's now referring to a particular circumstance where you don't do the prostrations after the salam. You do them before the salam. And that's the one I mentioned to you a little bit earlier. So he said, lakin, but qad yabin, there can be a different situation here. In other words, it's not after the salam, it's before the salam. Lian banaw fi fi'lihim. And that is when somebody builds upon their actions. In other words, They assume that what the rak'ah that they're doing is the first one, and the ones that came before that were abrogated are annulled. So they're starting from where they know that it is valid. That is building. You build from there. This is your first rak'ah. The next rak'ah is your second rak'ah, and you don't make up the one that's missed. You just remove it completely, as if it didn't exist. So in their actions, they're doing that, but by doing that, the qawl, which is the recitation, what you say, is lacking in the in one of the rackets where it should be more. Because they've built rather than made up, the recitation is lacking in a rakat where there should be recitation of a surah. So the example here is if you're doing dhuhr and you do something wrong in your first rakat or your second rakat, so you have to abrogate one of those rakats. And then you realize after the recitation in your third rakat. So in the first rakat, you did, say you're doing, let's say you're doing Isha. In the first rakat, you did the Fatiha and the surah out loud. Then in the second rakat, you did the surah and the Fatiha out loud. Then in the third rakat, you recited the Fatiha silently. Then you thought, oh my God, in the first rakat, I missed out a sajda. It's too late to go back and make that sajda up. That rakat's long gone. It's been separated by two rukus in this case. So you can't make it right. So you just have to get rid of that as if it doesn't exist. So basically that third rakat that you just did the Fatiha silently in is now your second rakat. And because you're building upon what you have done that is valid, you have a second rakat in which you didn't do what you should have done in terms of recitation.
So tashahhud comes again as well.
So yeah, basically at the end of that third rakat, you would do tashahhud. Because it's the end of your second rakat. And then the last two rakats, you would just do the Fatiha silently because you're building. You're not making up. So then you've got three rakats which just have the Fatiha silently. And one which has the Fatiha and the surah out loud. Is that clear?
Yes.
So you've missed something out here, haven't you? But at the same time, you've added something because you had that whole rakat that was, you know, that was discounted. But because when you add something and you take something away, you give the weight to the thing that's missing, you do the sajdas before the salam. I mean, it's quite a complicated scenario here.
Yeah, but it makes sense.
Yeah. Is that understood by everyone online?
Can I ask a question? So you would definitely not on that third rakah, when you realized you've missed it, do an out loud recitation. That would be a
not if you realize after you have finished the recitation. By that, usually that means that you've gone into ruku. If you do realize in time when you're still standing, then you can go back and rectify that. But if you remember after you've already started to move into ruku, it's too late.
That's perfect. Thank you.
So he says here, li anbanaw fi fi'lihim, when they build on their actions, wal qawl, and by doing that, what they say, their recitation is naqs, is deficient, bifawti surah, by the surah being lacking, bal qabli, in that case, you do the sajda before the salam. In the same way as you do the sajda before the salam, he's saying, kadhakiril wusta, like the person who is doing the prayer, and after two rakats, he forgets that he's the end of the second rakat, so he stands up without doing the tashahhud. Then just as he's standing up, he remembers, oh my gosh, I should be doing the tashahhud there. Yeah? In that case, there is something that you have to know. If your hands are still touching the ground, you go back. You go back to sitting down and you do the tashahhud, and you don't have to do any sajdas of any sort at the end of the thing. You just had that little bit of an extra movement, but that's not enough to require you to have any consequences. If your hands have left the ground, and remember in the Maliki Madhab, your knees leave the ground before your hands usually. So basically you're no longer touching the ground at all. Then you do not go back. You don't go from a fard, from an obligatory position, standing, to a non-obligatory thing, which is tashahhud, which is sunnah. Yeah? So, but you've missed something out here. You've missed out the middle tashahhud. So you continue with your prayer. You don't do tashahhud in the next rakah because that's your third rakah. You just continue until you get to the end of the fourth. And then once you finish your tashahhud at the end, then before you say the salam, you do two prostrations of forgetfulness. That's what you do in that case. It's like missing out a surah as well. So that's the situation that he's mentioning here. كَذَاكِ الْوُسْطَى, like the one who remembers the middle tashahud, وَالْأَيْدِي, and his hands, قَدْ رَفَى, have left the ground, have raised up. وَالْرُكَبًا, and his knees. So he's basically got off the ground. لَا قَبْلَ ذَا, not before that. In other words, when they're still touching. Before that, لَكِنْ رَجَعَى, if it is before that, he returns, he goes back. Yeah, is that clear?
Yeah.
Then we're moving on to a new section here, which is Salat al-Jumu'ah, the Jumu'ah prayer. And the Jumu'ah prayer has conditions for it to be established and conditions that make it obligatory on a person. The first thing, in order for there to be a Jumu'ah, is it has to meet the conditions for there to be a Jumu'ah in a place. That's the first thing you have to realize. And that's the majority of these early ones that he mentions here. So he says, Faslun, section. So, bimawtinil qura. This is the first precondition for Jumu'ah to be established. It must be in a mawtin, which is a settlement, a place where people settle. Of qura, of villages, in other words, built up places where people, the word qura means to have guests, to host guests, so a place that people consider their home, a dwelling place, a settlement that is permanent, where people have gone to live. That is the first condition, that the place where the Jumu'ah is has to be a permanent settlement. Only permanent settlements have Jumu'ah. Tents, non-residential places where people don't live, nomadic dwellings where people, you know, only stay for short periods of time. None of these, strictly speaking, have Jumu'ah. So, strictly speaking, in the Maliki Madhab, for example, have you watched Ertugrul? Those where they have their camp that they move from place to place. So they have it for maybe even a season in one place, and then they move to another place. That sort of camp you wouldn't have Jumu'ah in. In the Maliki position, because it's not a mawtin, it's not a proper settlement. So faslun bi mawtin il qura qad furidat, in a place that is a permanent settlement, and some people have made the condition they have a minimum of 40 households, but that's not one that's usually mentioned in the Maliki madhab. I think the Shafi'is might mention that as a condition, but it's like a proper place. I mean, the general position of this place is it has to be able to be somewhat self-sufficient. It can't purely be a satellite place for another, like it really relies totally on somewhere else for everything. It has to have some sort of independence as a place. It is its own place. بِمَوْتِ الْقُرَى قَدْ فُرِضَتْ صَلَاةُ جُمُعَةٍ لِخُطْبَةٍ تَلَتْ. In a place such as this, a settlement such as this, the prayer of Jumu'ah has been made fard li khutbatin talat. So it is fard, but it's fard when it follows on from a khutbah. You can only pray Salat al-Jumu'ah if it has a khutbah attached to it. You can't change your dhuhr for the Jumu'ah prayer without a khutbah. You can't think, okay, all right, let's just leave the khutbah today. We'll just shorten our prayer and have two rakats today for Jumu'ah. Everyone's here. Not time for the khutbah today, no. The khutbah is a condition of Jumu'ah. And strictly speaking, a khutbah is two khutbahs. Every type of khutbah that we have in the deen, whether it's the Eid khutbah, the khutbah of the rain prayer, or this particular khutbah, is comprised of two khutbahs. And it is recommended that the imam sits in the beginning of each of those khutbahs, that there has to be a break between them. Doesn't necessarily have to sit, although some people say it's an obligation between them, but there has to be something that is a recognizable break between them for it to be valid. And a khutbah only has to be what the Arabs considered to be a khutbah, which is simply, if I was just to say there, stand up and say, La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, and then sit down. Or subhanallah wa la ilaha illallah, and then sit down. That's not considered a khutbah. That's considered dhikrullah, yes, but it's not considered a khutbah. Khutbah involves some sort of encouragement or asking people to do something or telling them about doing something. That's what a khutbah has as a bare minimum. It's recommended that a khutbah have hamd and salat and ala nabi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam in it at the beginning, and that it comprises at least some Quranic ayat or other, and that these obligatory elements at the bare minimum be in Arabic. In fact, there is a position that the khutbah has to be completely in Arabic. But obviously, there is an element of the khutbah, which is that it's a tadhkira, it's a reminder. And if everybody doesn't understand Arabic, then that aspect of the Jummah is not met. The reason people say it has to be in Arabic is because it takes the place of two rakats of the prayer. And you can't do any part of the prayer in foreign language. But having said that, I've heard this from the ulama in Morocco and places like that it has to be in Arabic. But I've attended their khutbas, and they often explain things in the local dialect. And some of those local dialect words derive from non-Arabic languages. So although they say that, there is the assumption that even though every part of that local dialect is pure Arabic.
In the, you're saying two khutbas, the gap in the middle. What is there a name for that where the dua is made?
No, it's just a gap. There's nothing particular that has to be said.
Generally, people make a dua.
Yeah. But there's nothing specific that has to be said. There are recommended things to be said, but nothing that is absolute that if you don't do that. The other thing with the khutbah is the imam is recommended to have a stick or a spear or a bow or even a sword maybe upon which he leans while he's doing the khutbah. That's another important aspect. It's recommended that the people who are listening to the khutbah turn to face the imam, rather than simply, facing the Qibla if it's a long way from the imam. You know, some mosques, they may be 100 yards wide. You're just facing forward, and the imam is way back to your right. You're not fulfilling the recommended act of that. The khutbah should be delivered standing. Its time is after the sun has reached its highest point in the sky, the zenith. If you start the khutbah before then, you have to do it again, because its time is the same as the time of Dhuhr. The end of the time for Jumu'ah, by the way, some people think it has to be done in the time of Dhuhr. Of course, it's best to be done in the time of Dhuhr. But the strongest position is that it stretches all the way up to Maghrib. So basically, if you can finish the khutbah, get in the two rakats of Jumu'ah and get in one rakat of Asr, you have caught its time. Otherwise, you've missed its time completely. If you miss its time, obviously you have to pray, make up Dhuhr. You can't make up Jumu'ah. It must be delivered inside a mosque. And that brings us to the next one of the things that he mentions here. Bijami'in, in a jami'. This is a very important requirement that maybe is different between the Maliki madhab and some of the other madhabs. We only allow the khutbah to be given in a building that is being given over as a waqf in the way of Allah, as a mosque for people to worship Allah. That has the five daily prayers, doesn't necessarily mean that they always have to be established, but the possibility of them being established is a mosque that's open at all times, in other words. That is the bare minimum requirement for this building. And another aspect of this mosque, I don't know if it's specific to the Maliki madhab, but there should only ever be one Jumu'ah mosque in any location, especially those locations that are smaller. So if you had a town or a village or a place that only had a few thousand Muslims or a few hundred, or even a few hundred Muslims, it's not permitted to have a second mosque that does the Jumu'ah unless the first one is full and there's no way of expanding it. And there's no space for people to pray outside of it. Because sometimes you find people praying in the streets around some of these mosques. It's not permitted. Ala muqeemin. Before I go there, let's just see if we've... Yeah, going through these other conditions for Jumu'ah, before I go on to that, there has to be a minimum of 12 men throughout the entirety of the khutbah and the entirety of the prayer, excluding the imam, upon whom the jumu'ah would be obligatory. In other words, those 12 men must be resident, obviously Muslim. They must be resident, they must be free, they must be adult. They must remain in wudu throughout.
Is it 12 men?
Yeah, because if one of them leaves to go and do wudu, that's... So that, if any of that, and if any of those men go away, the whole Jumu'ah is invalidated.
Including the imam.
I mean, so long, obviously, though, if the man comes back and there's enough to constitute a khutbah, still that he's there for, and then the prayer, then that would be valid. But he has to catch the khutbah, and he has to catch the prayer. Mm. But they do say it should be throughout the entirety of the khutbahs, because you should be present for both khutbahs. Mm. But it's not a jumu'ah without that condition being met. And finally, you can't have jumu'ah without an imam. You can't have a lot of people come. One of the congregation gets up and does a khutbah, and everybody then goes and prays their jumu'ah on their own, and then goes off. The whole purpose of it is jama'ah, bringing people together, praying together. And the fact that it can't be done without an imam, one of the conditions on this imam, by the way, is that he has to be resident. You're not allowed to have a traveling imam. What does resident mean? Resident means that he's intended to stay there for 4 days or more. If a scholar comes from somewhere else, just for the Jumu'ah, comes and delivers the Jumu'ah and then goes off, that's not permitted in the Maliki Madhab. The only exception to that, the only time a traveler is allowed to lead the Jumu'ah, is if he's the Khalifa or one of his representatives, because he has the primary right of leading any prayer or any Jumu'ah anywhere in the land. Basically, in a sense, he's considered resident everywhere. But apart from that, it's not permitted to have somebody come as a traveler and lead the khutbah. Invalidates it. It's invalid. Oh, and another thing that you see commonly, which is not accepted by us, is the person who gives the khutbah must be the person to lead the prayer. You cannot have one man give the khutbah and another man give the prayer. The only exception to that is the same exception we have for any other prayer, when he's forced to get a substitute to substitute for him. Maybe he falls sick, or maybe, you know, he breaks wind after starting the prayer or something, has to get somebody else to come and take over. Other than that, you cannot have a separate person leading the Jumu'ah prayer to the one who gave the khutbah. They must be the same person. As for the shurut al-wujub, or the things that make Jumu'ah obligatory on you, he says here, it is obligatory ala muqim, on somebody who is resident. In other words, if you're traveling, Jumu'ah is not obligatory on you. And that's actually the reason why a traveler is not permitted to lead Jumu'ah. Because you can't, if something is a nafila for you, lead somebody who's doing a fard. Doing the Jumu'ah is nafila for him. It's not obligatory. Obligatory would be for the dhuhr for him. So it's a nafila that actually does take the place of dhuhr, even though it's nafila for him to do Jumu'ah instead of dhuhr. That's a rare exception, but it's not an obligation on him. And you can't have somebody who has a different intention. His intention is not to meet an obligation, because it's not obligatory on him. That's also why it's not permitted to have a slave be the imam in Jumu'ah, as we're going to come to a bit later, because it's not obligatory on a slave to pray Jumu'ah. Ala muqimin man adhar, who has no excuses that prevent him. So an example of an excuse that might prevent, you're very sick. and it's extremely difficult for you to get to the mosque. That's an excuse to not go to Jumu'ah. You're resident. By the way, the other thing is, I didn't mention here, being resident, but there's another condition of closeness, which is a farsakh. Does he mention it in the Arabic here? Qaribin ka farsakh, who is close, such as a farsakh. A farsakh or parsec is 3 miles. So if you live more than 3 miles from the mosque, such as yourself, Jumu'ah is not obligatory on you in that mosque. Maybe there's another mosque that's within 3 miles. Jumu'ah is not obligatory if you live outside of this radius of approximately 3 miles. Doesn't mean you shouldn't go, but it's not obligatory on you. And again, if it's not obligatory on you, that also indicates that the imam, strictly speaking, should be somebody who lives less than 3 miles from the mosque. Because if it's not obligatory on you, if you're more than 3 miles away, then he's somebody who's doing something that's not obligatory on him. So man adar, who doesn't have an excuse, as I said, an excuse may be illness, an excuse may be looking after somebody else who's sick, or looking after children because your wife is sick and can't look after the children, for example, or maybe suffering from a condition that you have extremely bad body odor or extremely bad breath, and you've tried medication, it's not got rid of it. And if you go to the mosque, you know it's going to put a lot of people in an uncomfortable position because of that smell. That's also an excuse to not go to the mosque. Or maybe it's extremely hot and you're very sensitive to the heat, and the only way for you to get there is to walk, for example. Or the rain is really strong, or the terrain is very dangerous because of the weather conditions that have been previously. All of those are valid excuses to not go to Jumu'ah. Otherwise, Jumu'ah is an obligation. And they talk about if you miss 3 Jumu'ahs in a row, some people have even said that's as much as making you kafir, according to some. I mean, obviously, that's just an extreme. But that shows you, if you're missing Jumu'ah, the Messenger of Allah said that, you know, if he'd been allowed, he'd have sent people around to beat people, or set their houses on fire to make them come to the Jumu'ah, you know? It's a big thing, attending the Jumu'ah. It's where all the Muslims get together, which is why it's recommended, even for people who it's not obligatory for them to come, as he's going to mention in a minute. Because this is where the heart, the beating heart of a Muslim community is. The Jumu'ah prayer, where everybody gathers, especially the men. Hurrun, as I said, can't be a slave. He has to be free. Dhakar, the last condition of an imam leading the Jumu'ah, and this actually applies to an imam in general, is that he is male. He doesn't mention some more, but we'll come to that later. Is that he mentions the conditions of being an imam. And the conditions of being an imam have more things apart from just being male. And obviously, if you're an imam in Jumu'ah, you have to meet all of those conditions. But the bare minimum one that he's mentioning here is that you are male. A female is not allowed to lead the Jumu'ah prayer. وَأَجْزَأَتْ غَيْرًا So he says, the people for whom Jumu'ah is not obligatory. The question's asked, Dhuhr is obligatory, so how can you get rid of something that's not obligatory, that is obligatory, for something that's not obligatory? If somebody does Jumu'ah and it's not obligatory for them, but Dhuhr was obligatory, you might ask the question, well, is that valid? You've left something that's obligatory for something that's not obligatory on you. And he says, yes, it's valid. Don't worry, you're okay. Even if you're a traveler and you decide to go to the Jumu'ah and not pray Dhuhr, pray the Jumu'ah instead, don't worry, your Dhuhr is covered. You're right. وَأَجْزَأَتْ غَيْرًا, so that includes, obviously, by the way, here, this is not about Imam Dhakar. I was getting confused with the section I dealt with earlier. Dhakar is a condition for Jumu'ah being obligatory. So Jumu'ah is not obligatory on women. It's only obligatory on men. It's obviously not obligatory on children either, because nothing in the deen is obligatory on children. But it's not obligatory on women, but that doesn't mean that women shouldn't come. That's why he's saying here, وَأَجْزَادْ غَيْرًا. Other than those. Then we come to the issue of women attending the mosque. So classical fiqh books are quite hard on this. You find a lot of classical fiqh books will say that older women may come with no dislike. Younger women who are not a source of fitna, it's disliked for them to come, but they may come. And young women who are a source of fitna, they are forbidden from coming. But that you have to realize the circumstances they were talking about. This was when it was very rare to see a woman out and about in the streets or in society or anywhere out in public. Because in those days, men tended to do most of the public works and women did most of the work within the home environment. So it was actually quite rare to see women out and about. And so when you saw them, you know, it was something that you were attracted to look at them. But in this day and age where basically not just women are everywhere in that sense, but women are not even clothed in covering their aura in these days where you see them everywhere. So it's not really a source of fitna anymore, because it's something that people just got used to. So women coming to the mosque is not really a source of fitna in the same way that it was. And the reason for the prohibition was based on fitna. It wasn't based on anything in a woman that says they shouldn't come to a mosque. It was simply based on trying to avoid interactions between men and women happening that might lead to haram. And in this present era, that sort of fitna is not really caused by women coming to the mosque. As far as I can see, Allah knows best. Mm-hmm. There may be circumstances where that happens. So if the basis for the ruling is fitna, and that fitna is not happening, then that sort of prohibition or dislike is removed. So he says, وَأَجْزَأَدْ غَيْرًا, other than them, it takes the place of the dhuhr. It counts for them. نَعَمْ, yes. قَدْ تُنْدَبُ, yes, it can even be said that it is recommended in some of these people, for some of these cases. And as I said, for that they were referring to slaves and travelers and older women, and we're excluding younger women. But in the modern era, I see no harm in including all women in the sense of being recommended, given that it's the place where Muslims congregate. And the fitna aspect is not as big an issue as it once was. Inda nida as-sa'yu ilayha yajibu. So when is it obligatory to go to Jumu'ah? You said it's obligatory. When does it become obligatory for you to go to Jumu'ah? Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu idha nudiya lis-salati min yawmil jumu'ah fas'aw ila dhikrillah wa dharul bayt. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in Surah Al-Jumu'ah, which actually is recommended to recite in the Jumu'ah prayer, if you know it. O you who believe, when the call to prayer is given, idha nudiya lis-salati min yawm for the Jumu'ah prayer, فَسْعَوِ لَا ذِكْرِ اللَّهِ, hurry, drop everything, hurry to the remembrance of Allah, in other words, the khutbah, وَذَرُ الْبَيْءِ, and leave selling, leave transactions. So when you're coming to the Jummah, you know there's more than one adhan. There's one that marks the beginning of the time, and there's one that marks when the imam comes out and sits on the minbar. It's referring to the second one. When the imam sits on the minbar and the muadhin stands up to call the adhan, at that moment, whoever hears the adhan has to drop what they're doing. Whoever hears the adhan at that moment must, if they meet all these characteristics of Jummah being obligatory on them, they must leave what they are doing and come straight to the mosque. If they are engaged in selling a house or buying a drink, they have to stop doing that. They're no longer allowed to do it. They are getting married. Stop. You're not allowed to get married at that point, once that's happened. If you're about to travel on a journey, stop. You're not allowed to travel at that moment. In fact, you're not allowed to travel from the beginning of the time of Dhuhr on the day of Jumu'ah strictly. unless there's absolutely no way of avoiding it. In the modern era, it's become a darura in certain situations, such as flights only existing at certain times. And if you have a choice, you're not allowed to travel. In fact, it's disliked to travel from the time of Fajr on the day of Jumu'ah. You shouldn't be traveling on that until after the prayer is done, in which case, permitted to do anything.
That's from Fajr to after Jumu'ah.
Yeah. Well, it's disliked from Fajr until beginning of Dhuhr, and then it's forbidden from Dhuhr until after you've prayed Jumu'ah. You're not allowed to do any form of transaction at that point, financial transaction or even marital transaction, all types of transaction. If a transaction is done at that time, it's considered null and void. It's considered like a marriage that's convened at that time. If they discover it later, they found out that they're not really married. Obviously, certain things are overlooked in terms of it's not considered strict zina, but that they have to get remarried. It's not counted as a marriage, for example. So what's sunnah for Jumu'ah? He now says, so these are the things that are required for Jumu'ah. What's sunnah for it? He says, well, sunnah ghuslun birrawahi tasala. So the main sunnah for Jumu'ah, by which it's known, is the ghusl. And that ghusl should be done not at the beginning of the day, and then you go about your affairs and then go to the mosque. Should be done when you are about to leave for the mosque. So you do your ghusl, and then you get dressed and a few other things, but you're basically doing your ghusl, getting ready for the mosque, going to the mosque. You don't do your ghusl, then do your morning's work, then go to the mosque. It's okay, it will still count, but you won't have done it in the ideal way, which is that it's connected to going to the mosque. A couple of other things. Basing the khatib, as I mentioned earlier, that's actually a sunnah rather than recommended, so it's a strong thing. And the sitting for the khatib is also sunnah between the two khutbahs and at the beginning of the first khutbah. Then he says, nudiba tahjirun. These are the things that are now mandub. Mandub meaning recommended. Mustahab. Okay. Mandub meaning recommended. So the first thing he says is tahjir, which can be the hajira is the hottest part of the day. What used to happen was, in order to avoid people getting sick or because of the extreme heat, they would delay the Jumu'ah until the temperature had died down a bit. So it would be delayed a little bit, maybe 3 or 4 or whatever it is. Be a bit later for people to make it easier for people. And back in the day when people were walking and there wasn't much to protect from the sun and it was extremely hot. But he's saying here, it's actually recommended for you to go out in that midday heat to get to the mosque early. Even when it's, when it's delayed because of the heat, you go out, even in the heat, go there and get your place, get your camel. Or the famous hadith, the one who gets there in the first part of the time. So getting to the mosque early is recommended. You get more reward. That time before the Jumu'ah is an extraordinary time when the angels are there writing down all of the actions of the people who are doing dhikr in the mosque. And, it's a time where you should be focusing on dhikrullah, recitation of Quran, more than anything. So in fact, this thing that people do of having talks in the mosque before the thing, for us, we don't do that, because that is a time when you should be focusing on dhikrullah. And in fact, Imam Malik disliked tahalluq, the forming of study circles before Jumu'ah in the mosque. It's not the time for it. It's time for recitation of Quran, dhikrullah.
How early should one arrive to Jumu'ah?
An hour. Because when they say the 6 parts in the hadith, people say it's referring to the portions of an hour rather than each time it says the first hour, the second hour, the third hour. It's obviously not referring, because if you take that literally, you'll be going there before Fajr. Well, halun jamula. It's also recommended to make pretty, make beautiful your hal, your state, your... the way, your condition, everything about you. you groom yourself. Obviously, the well-known things of cutting your nails and trimming your moustache and all those various different things that it mentions, the fitros. Then, of course, there is wearing your best clothes. Ya bani Adam, khudu zinatakum inda kulli masjid. Oh, sons of Adam, take your zina, your beauty, beautiful things when you go to the mosque, but especially on Jummah, you wear your best clothes. Pure perfume. And all these things are especially actually directed towards the men. Again, they weren't so much directed towards the women in the past because of the aspect of fitna. But again, you can make a case that do those things cause fitna in the same way? Maybe some perfumes do. So certain types of perfume probably should still be avoided. بِجُمْعَةٍ جَمَاعَةٌ قَدْ وَجَبَتْ. So for the Jumu'ah, an obligation for the Jumu'ah to take place is that it has a Jama'ah. We mentioned that already. I mentioned it before he mentioned it because it was connected to the others. But obviously the Jama'ah with the Jumu'ah is a minimum of 12 men. That's based on the hadith of, or the occasion in Medina when the Muslims had been waiting for a tremendously huge caravan. They had no food and no drink. This great caravan was coming and it arrived while the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam was in the mosque delivering the khutbah. And everybody apart from 12 men left. Because they were, you know, wanted to look after their family. There was kids who were starving, all those various things, but they all left. And only 12 people stayed. Mm. So that was the basis for the minimum being 12. So it's an obligation for Jumu'ah that there is a Jama'ah. Sunnat bifardin. But Jama'ah is also recommended, more than that even, it's a sunnah, as he says here, for every fard prayer. Every obligatory prayer. I mean, he's referring here to the five daily prayers. It's a sunnah that we pray those in congregation, in Jama'ah. Because of the huge additional reward, but also, you know, it's the glue that binds the Muslims together. If you stand next to somebody in the prayer, they become somebody who is a brotherhood forms, you know, your hearts join by that action of joining together in the prayer. If you want to keep a community strong, you have a strong Jama'ah. It's something we could do better here in this mosque, but alhamdulillah, it's improving. But in every place, that is the glue that binds Muslims together, the Jama'ah. The Jama'ah, if we want to have a Jama'ah in everything, we want to have a Jama'ah first and foremost in the prayer. By the way, when this is something specific for men, women are very lucky. They get the reward of the Jama'ah when they pray alone. Whereas we have to pray in Jama'ah in order to get that reward. So I would say it's something that wives should do for their husbands. It's a great act of generosity by them to pray with their husband to make sure their husband also gets the reward. Sunnat bi fardin wa bi rak'atin rasat. So the Jama'ah. How do you catch the Jama'ah if you arrive late? What is the minimum that you have to catch in order to get the reward of being in a Jama'ah? He says, wa bi rak'atin rasat, and it is caught, it is made firm with a rak'ah. So you have to catch a full rak'ah in order for you to obtain the fadl, the reward, or the extra amount of reward for praying in Jama'ah. How do you catch a rak'ah? You have to get there, say your takbiratul ihram, and start moving into position before the imam has come out of ruku', before he's fully out of ruku'. So if you come and you find the imam in ruku' and you say Allahu Akbar, but he's already started to move, but he hasn't fully stood yet, after you said, as you said Allahu Akbar, and you quickly go down and then he says Allahu Akbar and comes up, then you've caught it. Doesn't mean that once he goes into ruku', it's done. No, once he comes out of ruku', that's, you know, sort of the rahmah. Gives you a bit more time to catch it. It's recommended, by the way, that an imam especially one who prays in a mosque, if he hears people coming and he's in the final rak'at, should give a little bit more time in his ruku' to give them an opportunity to get there. Wanudibat, and it is recommended in terms of jama'ah that a fadh, somebody who prays on his own, i'adat, that he repeats. So it is the repeating of a fadh, of somebody praying on their own, of it, of that prayer, is recommended. So this means if you pray dhuhr on your own at home, and then you come to the mosque, and you find them doing the jama'ah of dhuhr, recommended that you join them, even though you've already prayed dhuhr. But when you do, by the way, you should make sure that the intention you make is the intention of tafweed, handing the affair over to Allah. Because you do not know which of those two prayers Allah will take as your dhuhr and which He will take as a nafilah, as your non-obligatory prayer. So you hand the affair over to Allah because you don't know which one Allah will take. So you say, I make the intention of doing this tafweedan, handing it over to Allah. So it's recommended if you pray dhuhr on your own, or you pray dhuhr in a small group and then come to the mosque and it's a bigger group, that you join it again, that you do it again. Or if you pray in a mosque, say you're in Mecca and you pray in one of the smaller mosques, and then you come to the mosque of the Prophet ﷺ and you found that they haven't done the main jama'ah yet, even though you've already prayed in a mosque, you can pray again because you're praying in one of the three great mosques: the Mosque of Mecca, the Mosque of Medina, and the Mosque of Al-Quds. In those three ones, even if you've already prayed in a mosque, you pray again. Except here, la maghriban, but not maghrib. Why do you think not maghrib?
Is it a time?
No.
Numbers.
It's to do with the number of rak'ahs. Inna Allaha witrun, yuhibbul witra fi kulli amr. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is witr. In that case, you can translate witr as one rather than as odd. But Allah is witr, and He loves witr, things being an odd number in everything. Includes the number of obligatory prayers that you do in a day is an odd number. If you add up the rak'ahs, it's an odd number of rak'ahs that you do in the day. If you do maghrib at home on your own, then come to the mosque and pray three more, you have now got an even number that you have done ostensibly for maghrib and for the obligatory prayers. So you don't do it. So la maghriban kada, similarly, ishan mutiruha. In the same way, Isha, once you've done your shafa and witr after it. Why? Again, because it's an odd number of rak'ahs. This time an odd number of nafila rak'ahs. Because the time of witr is after Isha. So if you're repeating Isha, you would have to then repeat witr again. You understand?
Then it would be...
Then you would have an even number of nafila rak'ahs in the day.
Yeah.
So if you've done Isha but have not yet done witr, you do Isha at home and then you come to the mosque and they're doing Isha, but you haven't done witr yet, yes, join in, it's fine. But if you did Isha and your shafa and witr at home and then came to the mosque and they were doing Isha, can't do it. Missed the boat on that one. Not going to get the extra reward for praying in jama'ah in that case.
Is it true that when you do witr already at night, your prayers are closed, you can't pray anymore?
If you go to bed, and what you shouldn't do is you shouldn't pray witr and then deliberately, immediately after that, start praying other rak'ahs. You should make it the last of the rak'ahs of your wird or your group of prayers that you're doing. But if you are never sure that you're going to get up, you always intend to get up, but some, you know, it's difficult for you. Some nights you do, other nights you don't. So you always do your witr early. Then you actually do manage to get up, having done the witr, then you can do rak'ahs in the night. You don't repeat the witr. So, moving on, the shurut al-imam, the conditions for the imam. There are certain conditions or requirements that an imam must meet. If an imam does not meet these things, any prayer behind him is invalid. Yeah? And there are other ones that he should meet, but if he doesn't, your prayer is still valid. And they're what's called the things that it's disliked to be with an imam. So you can call those shurut al-kamal, the preconditions of completeness, or you can simply call them the things that are makruh, that are disliked for an imam. But the first category are the ones which are most important, and they are the things that an imam cannot have. If a person has this, then if he leads you in prayer, your prayer is invalid and you're going to have to do that prayer again. So he says, Shart al-Imam, the preconditions for an imam are first, dhakar, that he is male. If you pray behind a female, you pray behind somebody who is between both sexes, a hermaphrodite, then there's some difference of opinion with the hermaphrodite, by the way, because some are closer to male than female. And if they are like that, then there's a difference of opinion. But some are closer to female than male when they have both parts. But they are very rare. There's not many of that category. So generally speaking, this is referring to women are not permitted to be imams. And that is the same regardless of whether they're praying on their own with other women, or with children, or whether they're praying with men. They can't lead men in prayer, they can't lead each other in prayer. And it said, because they've already got the reward of playing in Jama'ah anyway when they pray on their own. So, second, mukallaf. Do you remember what mukallaf means?
Response.
So, how does that work? So the two things here are mukallaf, that they are sane, and that they have reached the age of puberty. What does this mean? That if somebody has issues with their sanity, they should not be an imam. If you pray behind somebody who suffers those types of states, or maybe is suffering from that state when he's praying with you, your prayer is invalid. Similarly, anybody who hasn't reached the age of puberty cannot be an imam in an obligatory prayer. There's a difference of opinion about non-obligatory prayers, because you often have a situation where a young lad has memorized quite a lot of Quran, and for the Taraweeh, he's put up to lead the Taraweeh. The stronger position in that is that it's valid and it's okay, because it's not obligatory on anyone, the Taraweeh. Because the reason here that it's impermissible is because the prayer is not obligatory on him. And if you're not doing something obligatory, you can't be leading somebody who is doing something obligatory. That's the general rule here. He's doing a nafila, they're doing a fard. The intentions have to mesh. So a child cannot lead adults in prayer. Whether he can lead other children in prayer as well, that's another issue. And they say that's usually fine. If they're learning the prayer together, children can lead other children. But they cannot lead adults in any obligatory prayer, whether those adults are male or whether those adults are female. Next, atim bil arkan. This is talking about his ability to do all of the positions of the prayer. Atin, he comes with the arkan, the essential positions of the prayer. In other words, if somebody has a physical condition that prevents them from doing any of the positions of the prayer, he is not allowed to lead anybody who's fully able in the prayer. You're not somebody who's sitting for their prayer cannot be the imam of somebody who is praying the prayer in the normal way. Somebody who is standing but cannot go into sajda cannot lead somebody who is fully bodied in the prayer. If they are all like that, then having different types of disability perhaps, but all of them preventing them to do something, then that becomes permissible. Then you look at other things. But if there are able-bodied people and they have the basics to be able to pray, they know the prayer and they know how to pray, then he can't lead them in the prayer. وَحُكْمًا يَعْرِفُ, and that he must know how to pray. The hukum, the ruling, he knows it. This doesn't mean that he has to know what elements are far, what elements are sunnah, what elements are recommended, that he's memorized all of these various preconditions. He just knows what you have to do in order to pray. He doesn't know how to differentiate. The bare minimum is simply, he knows you have to be in wudu and you have to face the qibla, and those are the positions, and you make an intention. That's it, you know. He's seen people pray, he knows how it's done, and he knows what you have to say. That's what it means here. Doesn't necessarily mean that he can cover every scenario. Very, you know, you have a lot of... I mean, I was in a situation where an imam made a mistake and didn't know how to deal with it, but he was a man who had quite a lot of knowledge because he was actually an imam. So, I mean, it doesn't mean that here. Because obviously there's quite a few scenarios that, you know, you learn, but then you forget about. Or you can cross your wires in when you come to the situation and you become flustered and forget how to deal with it. So, I mean, that's not what it's referring to here. The bare minimum is that he knows how to pray. The next one, that can't be an imam, he says, the precondition of the imam is he's ghayru dhi fisqin. He's not a person who has fisq. Fisq here is sort of like deviance. Here it's mainly referring to in terms of belief. Although it can also, there's a difference of opinion. If somebody, for example, drinks alcohol, everybody knows he drinks alcohol, but then maybe there's never enough witnesses to actually give him a punishment, but he's known to drink alcohol or he's known to sleep around a bit. It's common knowledge, even though there's not enough to actually... Such a person is considered a person of fisq, fasiq, because he's doing wrong actions. And wrong actions, a person of fisq is somebody who's doing disobedience. That person, according to one position, is not allowed to be imam. According to another, it's disliked. When it comes to belief, if he believes things that are wrong, such as, for example, somebody who's mu'tazili or shi'i or khawarij, from the khawarij and things like that. Again, there's some difference of opinion, but the strongest opinion is that he's not allowed to be an imam. غَيْرِ ذِي فِسْقٍ وَلَحْنٍ. Lahn is an inability to pronounce Arabic properly. So if somebody cannot recite Quran at all, when he recites it, he butchers it. You can't even understand what he changes the meaning. You can't even understand that it's Arabic. It sounds so totally wrong. You can't understand it's Quran. If somebody has such a bad ability in recitation that it does that, then he's not allowed to be imam. If it's less than that, which we're going to come to, somebody who's called a canon, who maybe simply has a lisp or, you know, can't fully pronounce certain types of letters, or, you know, it's generally okay, but sort of some slight mispronunciations, that's, you know, that's okay. That's disliked, but it's not to the level of being forbidden. Waqtida. So this is another one where we differ from other madhabs. So he's a ghayri dhi iqtida. He's somebody who is not a follower. What does he mean here? In other words, he's not already praying behind an imam. So let's have a situation here where somebody comes late to the prayer. They join the imam, they catch a rak'ah with the imam, and then somebody else comes, everybody else has already left by the time this guy's getting to his last rak'ah because he's making up three rak'ahs. You come and you find him there. You can't take him as your imam because he's already made the intention of following somebody as his imam. I believe the Shafi'is allow this, sort of like this daisy chaining of imams. But for us, it's impermissible because he's already made the intention of being a follower specifically. If he just makes the intention of a prayer, then he can be an imam. But if somebody makes, or if you make the intention of being imam, or you make the intention of praying, then somebody else can come and join you and it's fine for you to be the imam. But if you make a specific intention to follow somebody else, then nobody is allowed to come and follow you as an imam. And then he says there's two more things about imams that apply only to Jumu'ah. That these conditions apply only to Jumu'ah. He says, وَشَرْطُ الْإِمَامِ فِي جُمُعَةٍ, and the conditions for somebody to be an imam in Jumu'ah are two more things. حُرْ, we mentioned these already, that he's free, not a slave. Second, مُقِيم, that he is resident. Very important. We already discussed those. Adada, these are the number of them that he's mentioned. Okay, so that's what an imam cannot be, all of these things. There are things that's disliked in the case of the imam. He says, "Wa yukrahu as-salasu wal-quruh." So, salas, I don't know if you, the people who were here a few weeks ago, we talked about salas. Salas is basically incontinence, whether it's urine, it's basically impurity coming out of your body without you being able to stop it come out. Whether that's urine, or whether it's wind, whether it's stuff coming out of your backside, whether it's pre-seminal fluid, all of these various things that we talked about that constitute salas, if they happen more than half the time, in other words, they don't break your wudu, then if they're not considered to break your wudu, this salas, this thing. So for example, if somebody has got the problem of incontinence with urine, where the urine comes out and he has no control over it and it's coming out all the time, that urine coming out does not break his wudu. If he farts, yes, that would break his wudu, but that urine won't. So if somebody has done wudu but has this impurity coming out of his body, can he be imam? The answer is it's disliked, but not forbidden. And the next one is quruh, and that is open sores or wounds where blood might be seeping out or pus might be seeping out. Again, if somebody has those things, it doesn't prevent him from being imam, but it's disliked because obviously he'll have impurity on him when he's leading people. So it's not just a weak dislike, it's quite a strong dislike. Then the next one he mentions here is badin li ghayrihim, and somebody from the country leading town dwellers in the prayer. Somebody who's a desert Arab, for example, leading the city Arabs in the prayer. This is disliked. Again, there's the possibility the reason for this could be because of the way that they were viewed, or that they lack certain knowledge of the deen in those respects, or they're a stranger. So, you know, an imam should be somebody from the people of the place. He should be known to the people. But another thing about the imam is that he should be respected. And if the imam has any qualities that takes away the ability of people to respect him, even if it's because of a prejudice that has no basis in reality, there are grounds for that person not to be an imam. Because it's a position of respect. People need to respect that person in order to follow him, in order to come to the prayer. If they don't like him, they won't come to the prayer and it will create fitna. I mean, it's important to realize this. So even if this person was the most learned of all of them, and more learned than all the townspeople, because of the fact that he's not one of the people, it's disliked for him to be the imam. The imam should be one of the people there. Or if this person was to move to the city and become one of the people, then that's changed the situation. But if he's, you know, just coming in as a country dweller, even if he's coming for enough to make him resident, it's disliked for him to be the imam. وَمَنْ يُكْرَهُ دَعْ, and then for those who are disliked, leave. In other words, this is not a small dislike. If somebody's disliked, then don't make them your imam, what he's saying here. Leave doing that. وَكَلْ أَشَلِّ, so these are also disliked, but maybe a slightly lesser level of dislike, these ones after this. These are the ones that he says these are the most disliked. These next ones are disliked, but maybe slightly less. He says, وَكَلْ أَشَلْ, like somebody who has paralysis in one of his limbs, or even in more than one of his limbs. He's got a paralyzed arm, for example. It's disliked for that person to be an imam, or if somebody's got a hand cut off or whatever, it's disliked. Again, this is because of people's prejudices. The way people tend to look at such people, it does take away some of the level of respect that they might have for that person. It's just human nature. And also, if somebody has that, it's difficult for them to get fully into a position. Is the other side of it. When your arm is paralyzed, it's difficult to fully get into each position. When your hand is cut off, it's difficult to fully get into each position. Wa imamatun bila rida. And then being imam without having a rida, which is the upper garment, like when you go on Umrah or Hajj, that you put over your shoulders, like a loose upper garment. When you're doing the prayer, you should have that sort of loose upper garment, even if you're wearing a shirt. You should have a loose upper garment over your shoulders. I mean, the primary thing is that you should cover your shoulders, because the prayer for a man is valid even if your shoulders are uncovered. But especially for an imam. If an imam is praying without that, it's disliked. That's what he's saying. But it's a lesser level of dislike. He says, wa imamatun bila ridan bi masjid. So an imam in a mosque praying without a loose garment draped over his shoulders. Salatun tujtala bayn al-asatin wa quddam al-imam. A prayer being the rows of which are prayed, the rows of which, or the people are praying between pillars or in front of the imam. So it is disliked unless there are severe constraints on space and there are a lot of people in a small space. If there are pillars in a mosque, if a mosque is built with pillars, like many of the mosques, for example, in Morocco are, even if these pillars are thick, you should try and have the lines before and after the pillars, not between the pillars. Mm-hmm. So you don't have any lines that have gaps, the pillars being the gaps. It's disliked for that, unless the mosque is really full, like on Jumu'ah, in which case it's no dislike. You can pray between those pillars. Wa quddam al-imam, the same praying in front of the imam. It's disliked, doesn't invalidate your prayer. It's disliked if you are in a position where you are closer to the Qibla than the imam. Because the imam is meant to be the furthest towards the Qibla. It's disliked unless the mosque is so full that some people have to be forced up until they are actually on a line with the imam or even in front of him, in which case needs must. It's a darura. Jama'atun ba'da salatin, ba'da salati dhiltizam. And having a jama'a in the mosque after the prayer of the person who has been appointed. So you have two types of mosques. You have mosques that have appointed imams who lead the people in the five prayers, and you have mosques that don't have that. If a mosque doesn't have an imam who has been appointed to lead the prayers, this dislike is dissolved. It's no longer disliked because you don't know specifically when you have to come in order to pray with the imam. There is no specific imam. Groups just come, like if you're traveling, you go to an airport, there's a prayer room. They don't have a specific imam who leads every prayer. Groups of people come, they pray as a group. Another group comes, they pray Dhuhr again as a group. Another group comes, pray Dhuhr as a group. No dislike at all. But if there's an imam who leads the people in prayer in that mosque, then it is disliked for another group of people to come and establish another jama'ah after him in the mosque. You might ask, what about beforehand? And in fact, you know, if it's a mosque that delays, for example, the Dhuhr, there's a mosque in Fez that delays the Dhuhr quite a lot, close to Asr time. If it's in such a mosque that's delaying the Dhuhr a lot, then there actually is no dislike in doing a jama'ah in the mosque beforehand, because you're doing it for a valid reason. Whereas the other one, if you're coming late for the prayer and you know there's this established prayer, it creates fitna. There's no need for it. You're not doing anything that's more beneficial, which is praying the prayer earlier in its time. All you're doing is creating a situation that might lead to fitna. وَرَاتِبٌ مَجْهُولٌ. And having an imam who is majhul, who is unknown. This can mean two things. One, you know, he's somebody that the people don't know, so they have no reason to respect him because they have no idea who he is. And two, they may know him, but they know nothing about him. He's quite a secretive fellow, so they don't know whether he's somebody who is a man of good action or a man of bad action. there's nothing in his reputation to say either. So this is a majhul, aw man ubbina, and this is somebody who has a bad reputation. So a majhul is somebody who you don't know whether he's a good or a bad person. Maybe you just don't know very much about him. An Ubbina is somebody who has a cloud over him. Somebody who has a reputation of being somebody who acts badly. May not be any truth to it, but that is his reputation. Such a person is disliked to take him as an imam, but not forbidden. Yeah. And it's not as strongly disliked as those earlier things that I mentioned. Then a couple more. Aghlafun, an uncircumcised person. Partly because, and this is not across the board. This is somebody who has had the opportunity to be circumcised, but has opted not to. Because it's seen as like a not doing a sunnah of the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. It also is considered a sign of uncouthness and lack of lack of cleanliness. Abdun, a slave. It's disliked for a slave to be imam, but not forbidden. Again, sometimes there were some incredibly knowledgeable slaves who've passed the deen down to us. So, I mean, it was not forbidden, but it was forbidden, obviously, in the Jumu'ah. But not in the daily prayers, but it's disliked. Khasiyun, or somebody who is a eunuch, or somebody who has been partially castrated or fully castrated.
Prohibited.
Yeah. It's not prohibited.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's disliked. He's still a man, but he's missing his male parts. So, I mean, so he's not, he doesn't stop being a man because he's had them cut off. So it's still permissible for him to be imam, but it's not at the level of permissibility, it's disliked. Wabnu zina, and somebody who has been born out of wedlock. It's disliked. In fact, it's disliked not just somebody who's born out of wedlock, but anybody whose parentage is unknown. Because a lot of respect for a person comes from where they come from. It's just human nature as well. So if somebody was a foundling, for example, and nobody knew who that person's parents were, the same dislike would apply, even though he may well have been born in wedlock. Wajaza, and there's some people you might think would be disliked, but they're not. He says, wajaza, and it is permissible, the inneen, which is somebody who is impotent, a man who cannot maintain an erection, or it could mean a man who is not particularly well endowed. Either of those things, it's perfectly fine. There's no dislike there. Wa'a'ma, which is somebody who is blind. Perfectly fine for somebody to be blind and be imam. Well, ken, somebody who has a stammer, or somebody who has a lisp, which stops his ability to say things super clearly, but not enough to make it what we mentioned earlier. Mujadhamun khaffa, somebody who has a light form of leprosy that is no longer contagious or infectious. So if it was obviously a severe case of something like that, he could not be imam. But somebody maybe who had leprosy or had some other skin thing and it left its marks on him. Maybe it looks a bit unsightly, but that doesn't stop him from being imam. وَهَذَا الْمُمْكِنُ, and this is what is possible for us to say here. In other words, there's lots of other things you might have said here, but this is enough. هَذَا الْمُمْكِنُ. So maybe we'll make that the place for us to stop as well. This is as much as we can say today. I mean, I know there's a little bit to do in prayer still, which we'll get through quite quickly, but that's probably enough for today. Are there any questions? I know we went through quite a lot today. Some things may be a bit unclear. I haven't had many questions off from the people online today.
I had a question, Sheikh. Given that Ramadan's coming up, do you think we'll be able to cover the chapter on fasting before Ramadan?
Yes, I think so, yes. Next week, we should get through this chapter and most of the next chapter. So we have three classes left before Ramadan, so I'm pretty sure we'll get to fasting, inshallah. I mean, I'm thinking that maybe in Ramadan, I don't know how busy people are, but maybe we can just do half-hour classes in Ramadan just to keep it going so it doesn't come to a complete stop. Okay, well, we'll finish there, inshallah, with the Fatiha. Bismillahir Rahmanir Bismillahi Rahman Rahim, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, Ar Rahman Rahim, Maliki Yawmiddin, Iyaka Na'budu wa Iyaka Nasta'in, Ihdina As-Sirat Al-Mustaqim, Sirat Al-Ladhina An'amta Alayhim, Ghayr Al-Maghdubi Alayhim Wa Ad-Dallin, Ameen. Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina Muhammadin Abdika wa Rasulika Nabiyyil Ummi wa ala Alihi wa Sahbihi wa Sallim Taslima. Subhana Rabbika Rabbil Izzati Amma Yasifun wa Salamun Alal Mursalin. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Thank you all very much. See you again next week, inshallah.